There are lots of different steps in terms of the analytical meditation on the self. And this is the one His Holiness presents in here, is fourfold. There's a fivefold and a sevenfold, and some more, you know, some come under names like the diamond slivers and so on and so forth. And there are others. I've just sort of given you some of the main ones. And there are two approaches you'll find in the literature, kind of irrespective of the tradition almost. And some begin with looking at the emptiness of things in the external world and then referring back to the emptiness of the self. And some start with the self and then transfer that by inference to things in the external world. The method His Holiness is presenting there is starting with the self. And it's quite a predominant one in the Tibetan tradition. And if we were to look, I can just give you however more steps or elaborate there are, you can, in logical terms, reduce all the arguments back to either the same or different. There'll be variations on that theme, and probably the most well known is the sevenfold reasoning, and that goes to Chandrakirti. So this one goes the sevenfold reasoning, and it's usually done, this one was originally done with an object, i.e. a chariot. And Geoffrey Hopkins has got a nice version in a book called Emptiness Yoga, done with a car. But the sevenfold reasoning will conclude that, you know, just as a chariot or a car can't inherently exist in the way we think that it does, so it is with the self. So the first one is the same. You check out whether it's exactly the same as its parts, the wheels, the axle, the frame, the seat, etc. That's the same as when we do with the mind and the body complex. And then you check whether it's other than its parts, whether this inherently existing one that is an illusion that we mistake for reality actually exists in that way. Then we look as if it's in the parts, and whether the chariot's parts are not in it, whether the chariot doesn't possess its parts, or whether it's not the collection of parts, or whether it's not in its shape. And that's exactly the way it goes with the self. Is it the same entity as the aggregates? Is it other than the aggregates, you know, for aggregates, read here, mind and body. But when you see the word aggregates, it's fivefold. It's form, feeling, perception, compositional factors, and consciousness. So is it the same entity as the aggregates? Is it other than aggregates? Is it in the aggregates? Or, and so too, really, the aggregates are not in the self somehow. The self does not possess the aggregates. It's not the collection of the aggregates. It's not the shape of the aggregates. And it's not their continuation in time. Yeah, so that's kind of sevenfold one, but you can see how really they fold back to same or different. So that's there, and there, lots there to explore. And so the last stage is coming to a conclusion. Yeah, remember I was talking yesterday when I read the parts out of the Rob Babia, that it's something that you kind of think about, I mean, there are occasions where you might just, you know, hear those arguments and say, yeah, it just, the penny just drops for you, you know, and it kind of works. But maybe it's interesting, but you think, well, maybe, maybe not. Yeah, that's interesting. And so the idea is that you kind of take this on board, incorporate it into your practice. So you kind of study in that way. You glance a bit when you're going around in the world, and you might check a few things out, both in terms of argument or how any of the kind of how the various parts, the five senses and mental consciousness, appear to us. You might do a bit of the kind of scientific work on there, you know, what does current cognitive science think and all of that, how does it feel to you, how does it work by observation, so a bit of a phenomenological approach. And then you bring the logic back, and you kind of, as I said before, it's important that you kind of understand the logical principles, and then you apply them in analysis. And then once you're familiar with the analysis, you can then bring it into meditation and use it repeatedly in meditation. And you, there's no need to go through the lot, you know, unless you're someone who, I quite like finding out what they all were, but not everybody might want to do that. I think what's most important is that you find and deepen on arguments that have some resonance with you, where you think, yeah, that's really interesting, that kind of hooks, as it were. But the important thing, and it goes, you know, right back to the fifth Dalai Lama, it's not just contemporary practices or me or anybody else, the fifth Dalai Lama was always emphasizing how important it is for the analysis not to become rote, but to be lively. Yeah. Although the logic itself might be dry, the application of the analysis and the finding out about the things that you're analysing should be something that engages you, and it should be lively. It shouldn't be just learning the arguments in somebody else's language and sitting there going, the self is either the same or different. It's going nowhere. It's going nowhere. You'll be bored in a very short time and say, it's not for me. Yeah, that's really boring. So you, when you search for a concretely existent I and don't find it either the same as or different from the mind of body, it's kind of crucial that it be alive as well as thorough. So you have to be creative with it. As I said, it has to get into your language, out of the language of the books. I mean, if you are, you know, really interested, you know, start to finish, in all there is to say about it, there it is in Geoffrey Hopkins' Meditation on Emptiness. It's a remarkable piece of work, but remember, although he's a practitioner, he's a scholar, he's an academic, right? And he's also interested in translating the Tibetan, so anybody reading it can take it from the English back to the Tibetan. And he's also used some very literal terms that would make sense in Tibetan, but to us, the English is unbelievably convoluted, and the terminology, you know, quite extraordinary. So if you want to go there, if you don't have to, that's what I'm saying, but if you want to go there, and that there's others that go, Emptiness Yoga is more readable and more practical. But if you want to, there it is. But if it starts to appear that it's really, really dry and you're just kind of learning the words and running through it, that's not going to work in analytical terms, in meditation, as it were. No, I won't. You can find out for yourself. I won't bore you with a part of it. But so from the point of view of your own kind of engagement with it, study, practice, and certainly if you're going to take it into meditation, then it must be lively. It must be creative. It must mean something to you. Yeah. But if you want to get from there to bring it into your own, you can. But there are a lot easier ways in, like this one, for example, to do it. So you've got to be creative with it, engage with it. And I would say actually engage with some passion and enthusiasm for it. In other words, don't do it. And why I'm saying that is not just because it's a nice thing to do, but otherwise you won't feel the impact of it. It won't happen. You just be thinking, oh, well, I'm saying all this stuff. And so. It'll be like learning something for an examination at school. So you have to really begin to start to question the strong sense of a self-instituting I and get to the point where you start to think, aha, you know, previously this kind of seemed to me to be so true and so solid, just a given, but maybe it's not really like that. And if you look back to Nagarjuna and Chandrakirti, acknowledged incredible masters of the tradition, they'd say, if your engagement with this, if you're coming to this or you're finding out about it, even gets to the point where you have one moment of doubt that you might not exist in the way you appear to yourself to exist, that is so unbelievably valuable and so rare that that is something to be bowed down to. Just to get to the point where you can have a doubt, yeah. Let alone being prepared to take it further, they would be like this. So it's as you then kind of examine and analyse further, you start. It moves towards conviction and being convinced. So it's not just superficial or intellectual, but something that really impacts and comes from the depths of your experience. And where this one's concerned, I would think if you feel some kind of resonance with it, then it's worth repeatedly reviewing those four steps to the realization of it. To observe and study when you're not meditating, to keep glancing and thinking about it, you know, check it out. And then, of course, we'll talk about that before we finish. There are kind of deeper levels to go. So for the analysis to be effective in meditation, you need to pass beyond mere words and really get some conviction that although it appears so concretely, it does not exist in that way. Yeah. Although you appear to yourself to appear much more solidly, much more concretely, you don't really exist in that way. And this one is really, really important behind it. It's not about the inculcation or the acceptance of another belief about ourselves. Yeah? If that had been the case, then the Buddha and Nagarjuna and Chandrakirti and everybody else would have said, the self you think exists doesn't exist like that. It's like this. Now, either believe it or don't believe it. We're telling you, pick it up. It's a religious tenet. Yeah. No. They're saying this is not about acquiring or picking up or getting from somebody else another belief about ourselves. Yeah. One of the reasons I was mostly attracted to Buddhism when I came to it early was because it was not about belief systems. Mm. I'd had enough of belief systems. Yeah. So that's what it's about. So the goal is a direct realization of the way things are. So the analysis and the phenomenological work is not some sort of inculcation or indoctrination, but seeing if you can get to the point where you think that's the way it is. But nobody else is going to decide that but you. You don't. I mean, the Buddha himself, if you go back into the Pali Canon, said, don't accept it because I said it. Don't accept it because some scripture says it's true. Yeah? find out for yourselves. His last words in the Mahaparinirvana Sutta was, work out your own salvation with diligence, basically. Mm-hmm. And he also gave an analogy of, which still holds, of people assaying gold or silver or precious metals or gems in the marketplaces in India. And he said, if they want to buy, you know, and you want to sell, then before they'll buy it from you, or before anybody who knows anything about it will buy it from them, they'll test it. And there are ways of checking. Is it gold or is it not gold? Is it silver? Is it not gold? And that's what the assayers do. You know, they weigh it, they check it, they break a little bit off, test it with certain things. And nowadays, that process has become much more scientific in terms of looking at the physics, the chemistry and everything else. But that's what the Buddha was saying, you know. Don't accept it until you are sure that it is gold in your own experience and by everything you can bring to bear to check upon it. It was echoed by Dinaga and Dharmakirti, two famous Buddhist logicians in India who were not only famous, like similar to Nagarjuna, they weren't only famous in the development of Buddhist logic, they were famous for the development of logic and philosophy in India in general, irrespective of the which religious grouping people came from. And Dharmakirti was very famous for saying, there's only two sources of knowledge. Yeah? The five senses and mental consciousness. Yeah? What you actually experience and what you can infer from it and do with it by thinking about it. And people said, well, what about scripture authority? He said, no, it's rubbish. It's not can't rely on it as a source of knowledge. It may be a source of support. It may be a source of inspiration. It may be that you come to the conclusion that you can rely upon the Buddha. So if the scripture contains his word, then you may pay more attention than that to another one. But at the end of the day, how, you know, if you want to know whether what the Buddha said was true in respect of your experience, the only way to find out is to do it. Yeah, to check it out, as it were. So it's really, really important that it's not a question of, oh, do you believe in the emptiness of self or not? And if not, you have to do a bit of work on it to convince yourself that that's the way it is, because that's the belief you ought to have as a Buddhist. It really is about saying, no, yeah, I think there may be some truth in that. I think it's worth working on. I get where it's coming from. Maybe it resonates enough. But then you actually do the work and do the meditation and deepen into it until you come to a point of conviction for yourself. Really, really important, that one. I probably over-egg the pudding, but it's a big one for me. And so the goal is a direct realization of the way things are. His Holiness in there, quote, I haven't got the page number, but I can get it for you. He says, this is the import of extended analysis, a decision from within your own mind that this sort of inherent I really does not exist. So, and you can kind of rest assured that because it's such a deeply rooted belief and perception about ourselves, there'll be a lot of resistance to letting go of it. Some people just encounter it and already they don't want to know. It's like, whoa, don't want to go there. So if you do decide to go there, we invest an awful lot in the inherently existing illusion. You know, we've invested a lot in it. We hang on to it. So many of us may not quite know what to do without it. And being without it may be like falling in the void. Who knows? But there's so much invested in it that it's difficult to imagine that unless you're very, very fortunate or just, you know, maybe see it or maybe have done a lot of work in the past, that there'll be a lot of resistance to letting go of it. I think it's sometimes when we say, oh, yeah, but it's all really difficult. I think a lot of that is because, oh, if that's true, that's really, you know, whipping out the rug from under my really, really comfortable and cozy feelings about myself and who I am. Yeah. So there will be resistance, and it won't necessarily be pleasant in the process. all I can say is, if you get just a whiff of the potential of it and come to doubt the inherent existence of the reified eye just once, then the prospect has the potential to be incredibly liberating and empowering. It's like the bars of the cage will dissolve. You know, you will not be limited by false ideas about yourself, either from yourself or from other people, and so on. So, Arjun, I'm trying to think of his, Arjun Amaro, who's the abbot of Amaravati in the Thai forest tradition under Ajahn Chah. He said, speaking about this very one, you know, the inherently existing I, he said, yes, it's funny. He said that, he said in English, it kind of works in your favour if you want to kind of have a bit of an image of it. Because he said the I is a straight line. Mm-hmm. So he said, I, they're the bars to a cage. And we make it, you know.
That's very true.
Yeah. So, as I say, there is. It's, I wouldn't pretend it's easy. It's not about picking up a belief. And if you go in that direction and try to do some of this sort of work, then not always. I mean, it can be, but and back to Calvino's lightness. You know, always take that to it, because in a way, part of what's being said here is, in a sense, the problem is, especially in this way, we take ourselves too seriously. You know, we take ourselves too seriously, and this kind of misperception is at the root of it. So even if it does get difficult, then remember at the back of your mind that the difficulty and the heaviness is because there's still that really, really over concrete, solid, reified idea of an inherently existing I that you don't want to let go of. And there's a lot of fear around that, and there's a lot invested in it. So that's probably where the difficulties are. But as I say, if you want to go there, then the and you have to find out for yourself. Don't believe it either. I could be setting you off on the road to madness. So, there is the promise of incredibly liberating power there, if you can let go around that one and see it dissolve. And there are lots of other ways of going there. Lots of other. I don't think there's any of the traditions, you know, of the Indo-Tibetan traditions. They have different emphases. But even in the traditions that come at it very experientially and very non-conceptually, we'll all do some of this. Yeah? The Gelugpa probably do more of it than most. Because if you look at it in terms of paths and say, Mahamudra, Madhyamika, Dzogchen, they're all methods almost on their own, but they'll all have a bit of the other in them, yeah? Mm-hmm. And it's just when people talk about greater Madhyamika, then it's like really following this one quite dominantly, mm-hmm. Yeah? But I think healthy to pay attention to all aspects, you know, development in body, speech and mind, development, a balanced development intellectually, emotionally and physically, no? Not being dominated by one or rejecting the other, and finding that's a bit like food, isn't it? Balanced diet is always better than extremes. So that's where we are on sort of coming to a conclusion with it. There's some more things which we can do tomorrow, which kind of look at a little bit about where it might go next, and most importantly, how this connects with compassion and love and liberation and enlightenment. There's a bit more to go. And I'm pleased we've got here, because there's plenty of room to kind of explore that between now and Saturday lunchtime, when we bring it to an end. Yeah, that in terms of connecting it up, the inseparability of wisdom and compassion. That will, and I can bring that aspect out and emphasize it. Yeah, because the Buddha nature, Tathagatagarbha, is really quite important. That, you know, there's a sense in which you say when you how to see yourself as you really are. Well, if you realize the emptiness of the inherent existence of the illusion of a reified I, then what you're resting back into and liberating is your Buddha nature. Yeah. Yeah. Which is a very different perspective on oneself. That's very much like where it's going to go from here, as it were, but in terms of bringing it to a conclusion by Saturday. So, but if you think back to yesterday, or was it earlier this morning? But I think it was yesterday, where I was reading His Holiness talking about his audience when he sits in front of an audience. Yes, he'd done that kind of analysis on himself. And he said when he saw everybody out there going, I, you know, and thinking, oh, they're all doing this too, the same as me. They're saying I and assenting to the illusion and assuming to themselves, about themselves and others, that this is, you know, the reified I that doesn't really exist, but they think does, and act accordingly. And if you remember, he's saying is at that point that engenders enormous compassion, because you know they're going to act and suffer and cause others suffering and vice versa, because they're acting out of a false idea of themselves. Yeah, they're acting out of a false idea of themselves. The false idea that they have, the false idea is real, but it ain't true. Yeah, so that brings in him spontaneously enormous compassion. I suppose in the same way, but at it's in a different modality. You know, when you were raising the question in karmic terms, when we were talking about karma, of what happens who's someone who's seriously mentally ill does something that causes enormous damage. You know, sort of, how does that go? Well, it's not serious mental illness, but acting out of illusion, because we're under the illusion of the power of this one, we view ourselves in a certain way, other people in a certain way, and do things that cause both us and them suffering. Well, that none of this is being done intentionally. No, it is being done intentionally, but based on an illusory notion of who we are. Yeah, so that should be a cause for compassion. You know, it's like, wow, if only they really could see it how it was, see themselves as they really are, they wouldn't be here, they wouldn't be doing this, they wouldn't be suffering, and neither would the people around them. Mm-hmm. So that it does for His Holiness, and I would say not to the extent of His Holiness, but it does for me. It's kind of... compassion is the feeling that you want to remove suffering. You want to take suffering away because you can see it's having an effect, and to do whatever's possible to alleviate the suffering. Yeah, kind of like that. Mm. So, if it's difficult to conceive a circumstance for me where that would ever be born of arrogance. Pity might. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, you know, poor them. They're under some illusion and suffering. I'm not. They are less than me. Then all I'm doing is refeeding my image of my inherently existing self. But if it's just a spontaneous feeling of, if only that suffering could stop, if only I could do anything to help that stop, having seen clearly, then I don't think that's bound up with arrogance.
It doesn't happen instantly.
No, it's
just a kind of
isn't
it? When you take the practice on board and accept that,
there might be moments of instantaneous appearance. You might have a moment where you either see something, and you're just in a different relationship to yourself and what you're interacting with in another person or persons, and it just might be a moment. So it. There can be instantaneous moments, but I think I'd share with you in terms of really opening up, resting in the Dharmakaya, and in a clear and lucid way, allowing unimpeded compassion to flow, well, you really have to dismantle the machine and realise your full potential. But that's not to say we mightn't have moments of... Or in the same way, we might have moments of doubt about the way we...
Yeah.
Exist. They'll come, they may come together because wisdom and compassion are inseparable in that way. Anyway, I would rather you talk than me. Keep jumping in. Sorry.
I feel just that.
Okay, I think for me, that one. What is holiness had to say when I read out there? Maybe I'll go back and reiterate that at some point. But it's like the previous moment of consciousness gives rise to the subsequent moment, and the subsequent moment gives rise to another one, to another one, to another one. And the transformation... If the continuum of consciousness continues, the transformation between life and death doesn't make any difference. It's the same principle of condition co-production and causality is going on. So it's not as if the fact of death suddenly changes this. It's happening right now. Has been happening and will continue to happen. That cookie won't crumble, as it were. Karmic or otherwise. Do you see what I mean? Mm. Yeah. And as His Holiness was saying, if there were such a thing as the misapprehended, inherently existing, reified I, then the continuum wouldn't be possible. It's not possible to continue. If we imagine that the moments are inherently existent in the same way, then that's it. There is no continuum anymore. In the same way, that quote from His Holiness was saying, I mean, I went less, didn't I? I said, you don't need an inherently existing I of that sort to sustain the idea of a continuum going across lives. He went so far as to say if there was one, then it wouldn't be possible. And I think he's absolutely right. I mean, this is really loose talk, but if you can imagine, if it is an interdependent universe, if one bit freezes like that, the whole machine's broken, it's gone. Not possible. Yeah? If it's interdependent, it's interdependent. Yeah, mm-hmm. And if one thing, fortunately, it's not really possible, but if one thing were to declare UDI and become completely independent, then the whole thing would either collapse or would be in a frozen universe or whatever metaphor you wanted to throw at it. So, and the same with our own continuum. Mm-hmm. Not only is it that we assent to an illusion of a reified I that doesn't really exist in that way, and not only do we not need it for the continuum to continue? But in fact, if it did exist in that way, the continuum would not be possible. Because if anything existed in that way, game over. Yeah? Mm-hmm. It's the point His Holiness was making about the Buddha. He wasn't saying, you know, I, Gautama Shakyamuni, did this in a former life. He said, in a former life, I, the Mirai, that which refers to this mental continuum, did that. Because if it's getting into the area of speculative stuff, which is somewhere that you probably gathered I'm kind of reluctant to go, but as the eye is dependent on the very things that Lin was referring to, yeah, so there's Roy as he experiences and senses himself now. Well, how much of that is dependent on my history, because I was born at a certain time, had certain experiences, did certain things? How much of that is dependent upon my body, my appearance to myself, its capabilities, its potential? Well, if you want to imagine, yeah, the continuum of consciousness departing and entering another platform, if you like, yeah, and that other platform doesn't have the same name, isn't born into the same culture, isn't born at the same time, doesn't have the same body, might not have the same gender, might be a different being. It's not going to be Roy running around as a cat, to use your example, is it? It's going to be a cat that's somehow the closest continuer to aspects of Roy's experience. Yeah, I'm not going to think, oh my God, I've been reborn as a cat. That's really not possible, really. Yeah, it's a bit cartoon like that, isn't it? It's good. Some good cartoons could be made, therefore. Or maybe back to Lucius Apuleius and the Golden Ass, where he's turned into a donkey for a while. That's a fun way of exploring those sorts of things. But no, so that's that. So much of our identity depends on, you know, what's right here, right now. But if that's not there, that's not to say it would be impossible for the continuum to continue, but it would not look and feel the same. Mm-hmm. Would it still be shaped by the experiences that it had? Yes. Would, from a Buddhist perspective, the karma still be, as long as karma's made, then the consequences and effects will come? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Another way of also getting at the in a little bit to the, you know, the kind of uselessness of the idea of anything existing inherently in an over rarefied way, and talking about causality to try and do a sort of an easy image, is you've seen the where people for fun get loads and loads of dominoes. And then you push, you make big patterns, you fill the room up with them, and then you push one and you watch it go all the way around. See how long it takes. Well, in a way, one domino hitting the other domino causes it to fall. But the cause and effect are the same. They're not inherently, not identical, but what was a cause can also be an effect. Depending on the perspective and its place in the chain, there's no inherently existing cause and effect. If there were, that phenomenon couldn't happen. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like that. Mm-hmm. So causes, although it's relative, dependent, context is all kind of thing, that causes are and can be effects, and so on and so on and so on. So continuums of consciousness are the same. If everything were to be inherently existent in the rarefied eye sense, nothing can happen. There would be no continuum. Mm. You'd have a series of moments going boop, boop, and then there'd be no connection or dependence at all, because you've already decided by definition that's what inherent existence is. So it's not... You see, the continuum needs the absence of inherently existing things, objects, persons, or whatever in that way. Yeah. It's how, if you read Nagarjuna's fundamental wisdom of the middle way, you know, it's it, how it, in the same way that in the accounts of the Buddha talking about the Heart Sutra on Vulture's Peak, there's a piece in there about arahats who were very conservative having a heart attack. So Karl Brunhilt wrote a book, commentary on the Heart Sutra. He called it the Heart Attack Sutra. Yeah, because they were like not ready for that kind of talk of fluidity, because they were very wedded to a kind of inherently existing stuff, as it were. But Nagarjuna had the same kind of impact where people drew breath, because he said, there's no inherently existing Dharma. There's no inherently existing Four Noble Truths. There's no inherently existing karma. Yeah? Hang on. No inherently existing. It's not to say it doesn't exist. It doesn't exist in the way you think it does. Yeah? No, they haven't. I mean, nobody went through saying put the word inherently in there. Sankarpa actually suggested that. I think it was Tom Tylemans actually did it. He actually said, I'll put all these in and look at that. He said, oh God, I've heard the word inherently too many times, sort of get the idea. But if you go to the Heart Sutra and read it, there is enough context to make that inference, and it's in the form is emptiness, emptiness is form, emptiness is not other than form, form not other than emptiness. So it's in that way there is no nose, no eye, no, and so on, up to and including no ignorance, no aging and death. That's straight, it's almost like that Nagarjuna has been exceptionally faithful to the Prajnaparamita literature. And the Prajnaparamita literature, the perfection of wisdom sutras in Sanskrit, are the foundation for the Mahayana. In the same way that the Pali canon is for the only remaining of just over 18 schools of Pali Buddhism, the Theravada is the only one left. So they're the sole representative of what was about 18 schools. But the Mahayana is emerges on the basis of the Prajnaparamita literature. So Nagarjuna was very faithful to that in articulating that. But you're right, when I first read it, I couldn't make sense of it. Yeah, I was thinking, what? And then its context gradually got it to me. And then when I was hearing about the idea of inherent existence, then I thought, oh yeah, now I get it. It's not whether it exists or not. It's not dialoguing between existence and non-existence, but talking about how it exists. Yeah, the way it exists. That really resonates with me, you know, in the sense of if somebody gets, and there's a lot there, isn't there? It's like the difference between response and reaction.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So just reacting out of, mechanically, like we're half asleep, in terms of not woken up to the reality of the way things are. So we're seduced by the illusion, still under the impact of a dreamlike kind of thing. We react mechanically with all the, how dare they? They've gone over the top. I want, you know, I've got to react, I've got to do this. And so all of that is very unpleasant, as you know. It may be possible to see someone really, really angry and respond. And if they are angry, and by any intersubjective standard, it's still not right, or they may have gone over the top, or they do and say damaging things, it's still possible to say, oh, I actually understand why that button got pushed and why they're reacting in the way that they are. You know, if they do something awful, that doesn't mean that has to be excused. In the same way, you can't turn up in court and say, oh, well, I was angry. They'll say, yeah, yeah, we know that. The problem is this one, you know. But nonetheless, from our point of view, initially in the less serious, you can then not have to react. You don't have to bite back. You don't have to. Or if that starts to occur, you can see that for what it is. See, that's perfect. The meditation of just picking up the feelings, that's exactly what you could do. If that occurred and it's still knocking around, you know, being processed, you can say, oh, I'll sit with that. But Paddy sent you an ordinary text at the weekend, and now he's blowing very hot, cursing you in no uncertain terms to me and anybody else who wants to listen, saying he texted you about something that was important and you've not even bothered to reply. You know? So I just emailed back and said, tell him there's no signal.
You mean no inherent signal?
Yeah. Just tell him there's no signal. You get it.
That's funny.
See, but there's one. See, it's that one again. Where it's a lot. And by the way, I'm not just looking critically at him because I could do it myself.
Mm.
It's like all I'm thinking about is I, me, mine. Mm. I sent a text. They haven't replied.
Mm.
How dare they? You know. Then I start going to their friends and saying, not saying, has Roy had an accident? Is there something wrong? You know, that would be more thinking about the other. But if it comes from this very, you know, that then we tighten up around all that. And,
yeah.
I mean, I've no doubt that the person who emailed me may email him and say there's no signal. He said, well, you should have told me. Anyway, you see what I mean? But, so we can, yes, this sort of reflecting, meditating, thinking about this creates space and gives us all sorts of possibilities.
Yeah.
It's liberating, even a little dose.
Yeah, it brings a lightness, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, it does.
Yeah.
And a lot of humour as well.
Yeah.
That's what it works.
Yeah. But there's a lot of the sort of meditations on the cultivation of compassion. And a lot of work that's come out of that, because in the same way that the mindfulness movement has come out of Buddhist calming and insight meditation techniques, lots of people have thought, if we can do it with that, can we do it with the cultivation of compassion and wholesome emotions and so on and so forth? And there are some people even thinking, if only we could get people to have insight into emptiness. I don't think corporations are quite ready for that, but they've bought compassion.
They've bought
compassion anyway. At least you can have compassionate work programs and all of that. But yeah, that a lot of those meditations start with I'm a human being, with all that means as someone who's not realised the emptiness of inherent existence for themselves. And they're a human being just like me. I'm a human being subject to all these vulnerabilities, fallibilities. It's a very good point you make. And it's like the recognition that however awful or terrible or irritating or whatever it is they appear to you, they're a human being just like you. Just like you. And already that's a different relationship. No? Puts you in a different relationship. It's kind of easier to do and cultivate in a meditation than in fast flow in the workplace, maybe. But the one can support the other and the development of the other. But it's often one we forget. You know, there's what the others and what they do, rather than thinking, hang on, they're human beings just like me, in the sense of being human, but also recognising that in their conditioning or situation, there might be some really relevant differences that, as human beings, we do well to pay respect to. But at that really fundamental level, the level of Buddha nature and common humanity, all the same. It's like if you look into the Bodhisattva's way of life of Shantideva, one of the ways of cultivating bodhicitta is called exchanging self for others. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's, you remember this kind of two methods there. One is the idea of thinking because of beginningless and endless lives, all beings have been my mother. They pick on the mother for all sorts of reasons, but it means it's in a recognition that if that's true, then we've been in all sorts of relationships with all sorts of beings and will continue to be so all of the time. That's one way of cultivating compassion, one method. The other method, well, they're often brought together in a kind of a 12-step thing, but the other one, which was Shantideva's, is this business of exchanging self for others and doing that by thinking, first of all, they're a human being just like me. You know, prey to the same issues, same circumstances, want pleasure, don't want pain. Then we, you know, we can really carry that out. Maybe they're also under pressure for money. Maybe they're also under pressure for job. Maybe they've also had a lot of trauma. Maybe they, to arrive where they are, you know, whatever it is, that's all going on. When somebody comes into work, how do I know what's happened at home? Or what other pressures may be bearing down on them, unless I know them very, very well. So that's often a good way in. And if you link to this idea again, it's that it's not that if someone's behaviour appears to be awful or whatever it is, it's not that they're inherently that way. It's that because of causes and conditions in themselves and elsewhere, they've kind of behaved or manifested in that way. So calling or labelling the behaviour is one thing. Saying that that's how the person inherently is, problematic. And probably not true. Yeah, I mean, for some things, it works at a number of levels, you know, from the initial or superficial to the deep. And someone once spoke to me a very useful kind of analogy of an old house. You know, imagine that before Land of Joy came here, that maybe, I don't know whether it was actually, because I wasn't up here when they first got it, but imagine a house like this that someone wants to sell and then they can't sell it for whatever reason, so they shut it up. And then maybe it remains shut up for years. And then when someone gets it or is able to open it, they just open the shutters and open the windows in a spring, and a lot of the mould that's on the walls will just disappear by the appearance of light and air. Yeah? That will just happen by insight, by opening up to it, by being present to it. But then, of course, there'll be really dirty stain bits that might need some extra work, which is, that's where you're going deeper with analysis, meditative consideration, and kind of repeated work, really, to really get into it and understand it. And it's where people who do tantric practices would say, we're going to accelerate that process using yogic methods, i.e. Vajrasattva purification and so on and so forth. So that can be brought to the party too, if you have a disposition or an inclination for that. Yeah. So yeah, there's lots of levels. It's actually called, if you look at the kind of stages of the path, then in five last stages, one of them's called no more learning. Well, that's exactly what the Buddha was famous for, his ability to teach people at different levels and different dispositions. Because without overcomplicating it, Buddhahood means the realization of full realization of potential. Yeah. And then it also depends a bit on your model. Yeah. So it doesn't really matter because the two different models are compatible and helpful, but you know, there's one model that would say you're already fully enlightened, it's just that you're so obscured you can't realize it. So then you're just unpeeling and allowing perfection to manifest. From another one, you've got a sort of a seed of perfection and you're developing it and feeding it and creating the causes and conditions for it to grow, and then it grows to full maturity. One's a kind of a discovery model, yeah, where you discover your own nature, your Buddha nature, and the other one is like Buddha nature as a seed, where you create the causes and conditions for its development, which is kind of a developmental model. But they don't need to be mutually exclusive. In fact, at a level further down, it's quite useful, and that's if you find yourself in a situation where it's just manifesting for you at whatever level. I mean, put it right back down to the shamatha level, not such lofty levels. If you've got the mindfulness and the introspection, and the mindfulness is always going, and it's really helpful to have the introspection doing this, yeah? And it works really well, and it's all going really well. And then one day you sit down, and boom, you're there, and it's not moving. And then this one goes, are you doing it right? Are you doing it right? This one's become useless, yeah? Because it was only a pragmatic device. So if you're there, you're there. If you're not, then development model is useful. Now that's putting it much more down to air level of practice. But if you can think of an analogous thing happening at the Buddhahood level, does that make sense?
Yeah.
Why I raised it from the point of view of from the point of view of the discovery model, yeah. Buddhism's got nothing to do with personal development. Yeah, I'm a bit scorching about the New Age movement for similar reasons. It's not about personal development, and by the way, a lot of that seems to me to be about the further and personal development of the illusion of an inherently existent I. You know.
So when I look at
personal, I don't want to knock the very basic thing of people saying I want to be a better person than I am. That's okay, but if I'm thinking about it from a Buddhist perspective, I'm saying no way. No, the learning that's talked about in the state of no more learning
is a different kind of.
You're not learning to get round the illusion. That wouldn't stop a Buddha learning a language. That's another level of learning.
Okay, so
yeah, do you see what I mean? I.e., the no more learning is
like reality.
Let's look at just along the dimension that we're looking on.
Yeah.
If you get to the point, where you are no longer at all ever seduced by the illusion of inherently existing self and other and things, and that's even got to the point where the illusion no longer continues to look like it is, but you know it, but actually disappears altogether, then that's no more learning. But in that fully enlightened state, realizing your full potential, if you need to help Richard and you need to learn Russian to do it, you can do it.
Yeah. Okay, that's
different
what I mean by
levels of. There's one way of looking at it, which is still really evident and really clear in the Theravada, and I like it. Mm. Yeah. Instead of getting lost in all the other stuff, just see the realization of your full potential or the realization of Nirvana as being nothing more but nothing less than the cessation of suffering.
Yeah.
End of story. If you were in a physical body, fully enlightened, you might still feel pain, but it wouldn't cause you any suffering.
One day. One
lifetime.
Yeah.
It's a suggestion for contention, but for example, I look askance if people suggest that there are fully ascended masters of whatever spiritual tradition walking the earth in human bodies that don't have the fallibilities that are required to be manifesting in a human body.
Yeah.
What's the difference? The difference is, from a Buddhist point of view, not suffering, no suffering, cessation of suffering. You know, if you think Maitreya follows the Buddha as the Buddha of another era and incarnates, when he incarnates, he has one of these. He has to enter the meat. He doesn't get a different quality one. He's born, lives, and dies. No? Mean in this context.
Yeah, exactly.
No more learning of what for what.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean nothing more to do if you wish to continue in human experience.
Yeah.
No.
I just wanted to clarify that.
Okay, good.
Thank you.
It's dinner time.